Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami. Airplane Mode, An Irreverent History of Travel by Shanaz Habib. Like exercise, flossing, and college, travel has long been held up as an incontrovertible good, an essential part of the modern human experience. Lately, though, there's been some pushback from the smart set, if not the jet set. The staycation, a word Merriam-Webster has traced to World War II advertising, lost any remaining stigma during pandemic lockdowns, with the air suddenly clear of traffic pollution and birdsong audible in one's own backyard. In The New Yorker last summer, the philosopher Agnes Callard laid out a case against travel, prompting a flurry of avid, even angry rebuttals and calls of clickbait from people who enjoy going to unfamiliar places, some pounded out indignantly from the road. And now lands Airplane Mode by Shanaz Habib, a lively and, yes, wide-ranging book that interrogates some of the pastimes conventions and most prominent chroniclers, beginning with the assumption that travel is a pastime at all, rather than a potentially violent upheaval or a battle with bureaucracy. Only Americans, British, Australians, and Japanese travel, a carpet store proprietor tells Habib when she visits Konya, Turkey, a variation of an edict she heard with more condensation in graduate school. People from the third world do not travel, they immigrate. Habib prefers the term third world to its more politically correct alternatives, she explains in a passionate afterword, praising a certain audacity of its unwieldy internal rhyme that Steely Dan has also noticed. She is a translator who has worked for the United Nations, and the English language is a source of sensual fascination. She considers the oft-criminalized practice of loitering, for example, so close to littering and its suggestion of something that shouldn't be there, and bringing also to mind the lottery and the gamble of waiting for something to happen. Habib was born in Kozhikode, India, and grew up in an unhistoric district in the seaside city of Kochi, a jumble of fish markets, sewing, and hardware shops that she thanks Robinson Crusoe for ignoring. Her father, like Macon Leary in Anne Tyler's The Accidental Tourist, hates to travel, preferring his familiar bed and reading online news. He declined a drive-by past the White House. Why? What is there? And declared a helicopter trip over Manhattan eminently avoidable. He gets to know foreign destinations by inspecting their fruits and vegetables. I love this guy. Habib marries a white American man who blithely assumes a baby moon to Paris while her green card is in process will not be a problem. It is impossible to tell a good story in which your primary antagonist is paperwork, the author writes, but she's wrong. The couple's quest for an advance parole, a forbidding-sounding travel document for non-citizens, plus a French visa that will let her go on this simple trip, is domestic tragicomedy of Lucy and Desi proportions, a video game with higher and higher levels of form-filling. Constrained at least intermittently from roaming the world, Habib finds ways to be transported, figuratively, from where she lives in Brooklyn. Postpartum, she takes long, aimless bus rides through its neighborhoods with her new baby, alert to how motherhood makes her less vulnerable to male attention. So much more of this to look forward to. She is a prodigious and skeptical reader, posing the Queen of Sheba in contrast to Joseph Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces, for example, or noting the marginalized characters in the colonialist-tinged detective novels of Agatha Christie and wondering about their stories. She analyzes guidebooks from Baedeker to Lonely Planet. Every time I pick up a guidebook, Lucy Honeychurch and Miss Lavish fight for my soul, she writes, referring to characters in the E.M. Forster novel A Room with a View, who, respectively, depend on convention and serendipity as they journey. How nice, by the way, to reclaim Journey from New Age babble. Even watching The Great British Bake Off, perhaps the feel-goodest program in the history of television, is occasion for Habib to consider how slavery, after forced travel under the most atrocious conditions, enabled the sugar trade. As for other travel writers, she seems through with Paul Theroux and is scathing on an article by Evan Osnos in The New Yorker about an all-inclusive Chinese package tour of Europe on which he was the only white man. But Airplane Mode is far from a castigating, joyless book, just one that urges readers to be alert to the world's injustices and impending catastrophes as they take their pleasure jaunts. Habib reminds us that Amartya Sen, the Nobel laureate, was detained in 1999 on his way to speak at Davos, and notes how the passport has increasingly become a transactional commodity rather than a national identity. Indeed, for every pandemic staycationer, it seemed there was another applying for a second passport. There are surprising detours about bougainvillea, leeches, carousels. She is conscious of how climate change will transform travel. Venice, anyone? And how travel has changed the climate, something that most million-milers just don't want to think about. My husband's decision to drastically reduce his flying on ecological principles has riled family members, provoked gasps at cocktail parties, and has cost us at least one treasured friendship. Me, I'm happy just to stay home binge-watching the great Smithsonian Channel series, Air Disasters, a weird immersion therapy for aviophobes. When Habib does get away from it all, she is a ruthlessly honest and funny observer, comparing her feeble herbivorous voice to the slashing adventuresomeness of an Anthony Bourdain, admitting to craving Thai food on a trip to Spain, and then exploring the forces that made it available there, confessing that she doesn't actually enjoy visiting monuments. Interestingly, for a book that takes its title from an iPhone setting, Airplane Mode doesn't much discuss how little super compasses like Google Maps, Yelp, and their ilk have changed everything forever when it comes to travel. But in an era when souvenirs are all but obsolete, every trinket on Earth available in a click, it's a lovely little snow globe, shaking up hardened perceptions. This review was written by Alexandra Jacobs, who is a book critic and the author of Still Here, The Madcap, Nervy, Singular Life of Elaine Stritch. Everywhere an oink oink, an embittered, dyspeptic, and accurate report of 40 years in Hollywood by David Mamet. David Mamet's best plays have impeccable titles: American Buffalo, Glengarry Glen Ross, Speed the Plow, Oleana. So does the best nonfiction book, Writing in Restaurants. Now, late in his career, comes a miscellany called Everywhere an Oink Oink. Oh boy, here we go. Sometimes you can judge a book by its title. The more brainless a book's intended readership, the more rib-nudgingly cute the title has to be, James Hamilton Patterson wrote in Cooking with Fernet Branca, his terrific comic novel from 2004. Mamet's new one isn't brainless. It's just random, his mind on shuffle. It's under-argued, rabid in its anti-wokeness, and haphazardly written. Reading this is not unlike sitting next to your Fox News-watching Uncle Alvin at Thanksgiving. There is a difference, however, between Mamet and the typical post-Trump conservative commentator. Mamet, who now writes for the National Review, has called himself a reformed liberal. The difference is that Mamet has a hinterland. He's written important plays and screenplays. He's got a well-stocked mind. He has a self-deprecating sense of humor. I was willing to put up with his loose elbows, his belching, his dandruff, and the way he repeats himself, because he's interesting and funny, at least a portion of the time. You may not be able to put up with him. If drive-by remarks about diversity capos and COVID annoyers, cracks about liberal policies on immigration and the homeless, and a declaration that we know a movie villain now by his white skin will sink this one for you, So be it. Mamet has largely thrown away his career over this stuff, he acknowledges. Sidelined because of my politics, respect for the Constitution, etc. The way to enjoy a meal seated next to someone you mostly disagree with, especially if they're old and grouchy, Mamet was born in 1947, is to look for the best in him, to seek common ground. So the rest of this review is going to be a bonsai-size rave, because I have a soft spot for this kind of throwaway variety hour book, of which Willie Nelson has also written several. Mamet, like Nelson, deplores corporate fat cats and their minions, the guys with the roller bags. At least a quarter of Mamet's book is an attack on film producers who do nothing but meddle and stamp their logos on other people's work, as if they were graffiti artists. In his book, The Tao of Willie, Nelson got off a joke about corporate guys that beats the ones here. What do a record exec and a sperm have in common? Nelson asked. They both have a one-in-a-million chance of becoming a human being. In Everywhere an Oink Oink, which is subtitled An Embittered, Dyspeptic, and Accurate Report of 40 Years in Hollywood, Mamet works hard to be epigrammatical. He sometimes succeeds. Directing a film is like playing chess while wrestling. I am willing to think ill of anyone, so I suppose I have an open mind. A laugh, like a lascivious glance, cannot be recalled. Hollywood is where nope springs eternal. If you put cilantro on it, Californians will eat cat expletive. I've always found the Pacific Ocean a bore. Never trust a Jew in a bow tie. Chivalrously, he gives several of the best lines to his wife. She refers to money, we are told, as shoe coupons. What kind of dog did she want? The kind that, if you walk it, it dies. What warmth there is in this book derives from his love for and encyclopedic knowledge of old movies, especially noir. He will make you long to watch or rewatch films like Sidney Lumet's Cold War thriller Failsafe, Jules Dassin's heist film Rififi, and the 1946 version of Razor's Edge, with Tyrone Power and Jean Tierney and Anne Baxter. The last time Mamet cried was during the film Random Harvest, with Ronald Colman and Greer Garson. He adds, filmed 1942, tears 1970. He relates, strange but true, his favorite World War I music hall songs. He quotes Tolstoy's observation that a marriage is in trouble when the partners begin enunciating very clearly. There are tangents on Dorothy Parker and Preston Sturgis and Francis Farmer and Barbara Loden and the poet Donald Hall and Frederick Law Olmsted. He reminisces about the making of his old movies, his missus directing. He likens it to leading an army into combat. He has directed 10 features and written 40 or so scripts, though only half got made. He lists the films he was fired from. He regrets turning down offers to write screenplays for Martin Scorsese and Sergio Leone. Mamet played four-handed piano with Randy Newman. He flew with Harrison Ford in his plane. Stanley Kubrick was his phone pal. He writes about Deborah Winger's high-stakes blackjack games with Teamsters on a set, and he sends up those same Teamsters by writing that they seem to be limited, while on the job, to three responses, whoa, hey, and all right. There is a good deal here about his friend, the magician Ricky Jay. Scenes are set, like the time Ridley Scott and Dino De Laurentiis flew in to see him on Martha's Vineyard to ask him to write the script for Hannibal. Mamet says he was a straight arrow on his film sets. That is, he never slept with his female stars. Mike Nichols, he tells us, gave him this advice. It is okay to sleep with your star, but it is not okay to stop sleeping with her. Mamet doesn't like that guys in old movies drink so much milk. He doesn't like that judges in movies are always threatening to clear the courtroom, but never do. Why do people in movies never recork their bottles? It is gratuitous woguery, in his estimation, that Best Boy is now head gaffer on film sets. Clamorous victims, out of his face. He judges men by their handshakes. About this predilection, he writes, as the cake so is the wedding. About his utter lack of zen, he writes, "Oh, embittered, embittered Dave." He refers to himself as the hermit of Santa Monica, shunning a world that has moved on, and to which his name is as the mention of Herodotus to illiterate youth. Herodotus knew that aging out of the things you love is awful. "The bitterest misery," he wrote, "is to know so much and to have control over nothing." Herodotus probably hated the new kids in town, too, because they were there to replace him. This review was written by Dwight Garner. He has been a book critic for The Times since 2008. His latest book is The Upstairs Delicatessen on eating, reading, reading about eating, and eating while reading. Two Wheels Good, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle by Jody Rosen. Books that offer the history of some single thing, salt, trees, sheep, trade in the currency of time. By tracking their subjects without special attention to mortal lifespans, they can guide us deep into the fathomless parts of the millenniums, tracing our surprising points of contact with the daily life of a Phoenician, a Junker, a medieval king. On such a timeline, the banal sometimes becomes strangely magnificent, rife with inadvertent human meanings. The bicycle was invented in 1817. Indeed, as Jody Rosen points out in his excellent new book, Two Wheels Good, The History and Mystery of the Bicycle, the first bike came into the world a decade and a half after the invention of the steam locomotive. It seems startlingly late for the arrival of such an intuitive and simple form of transportation, and that recentness suggests that, for all Rosen's dutiful consideration of the possible antecedents of the bike, he might be precluded from the effects that similar microhistories can achieve. In fact, the opposite is true. The narrow subject and relatively brief time frame of Two Wheels Good make it a crystalline portrait of modernity, the vexed, exhilarating, murderous, mechanized world left to us by the 19th century. The bicycle has touched nearly every element of life on Earth since then, it turns out. The Viet Cong used bikes in their counter-raids. Susan B. Anthony once commented that the bicycle had done more to emancipate women than anything else in the world. It was a Parisian bicycle maker who patented the ball bearing, the so-called atom of the machine age. We even rode it into the age of flight, in a sense. The Wright brothers were bike mechanics. The inventor of this wonderful machine was an oddball named Carl von Drais, who on June 12, 1817, demonstrated his creation to a spellbound crowd in Mannheim, Germany. It was called the Lauf machine, and it had no pedals. Though von Drais himself found scant acclaim for the invention in his lifetime, his idea spread immediately and irresistibly. It was not even 2 years later that velocipede riding was banned in London, Rosen informs us, a prohibition that didn't impede the British aristocracy in their passionate adoption of the new vehicle. Early bikes were expensive, 8 guineas, John Keats reported in a letter to his brother and sister-in-law. In the book's engaging opening chapters, the author tracks the bike from the primeval running machine of von Drais, Lauf is the German noun for run, to the bone shakers and high wheelers of the 1860s and 70s, those ludicrous penny farthings with the enormous front wheels, to the so-called safety bicycle of the 1880s, whose invention gave the bike the classic form we recognize today. From the start, as Rosen shows, the bicycle has magnetized political opinions. Its cheapness and mobility have aided insurgencies of every kind, whether feminism or socialism, and as a means of travel, it immediately challenged the moneyed holders of horseflesh, a people's nag, or, as a famous ad from the manufacturer Columbia put it, an ever-saddled horse which eats nothing. Rosen, a contributing writer for the New York Times Magazine, amasses his examples of these issues expertly. One of Adolf Hitler's first acts upon assuming power in 1933, he writes in a disquieting passage, was to smash Germany's cycling union. These political connotations survive into our own day, of course, with the crucial addition of the bike's negligible environmental impact. Those most likely to suffer the consequences of climate change are also the least likely to be contributing to it in their choice of conveyance. Around the world, more people travel by bicycle than by any other form of transportation. Two Wheels Good takes the form of bricolage, blending meticulous historical research, local reporting from bicycle-dependent locales like Bhutan and Bangladesh, and personal memories of riding in New York and Boston. Rosen is arguably strongest in the first of these three styles, but the book excels across all of them, and in its curious mingled character calls to mind Bill Bryson, John McPhee, Rebecca Solnit, obsessives for whom the material world and their own infinitesimal presence within it constitute the most natural subject of artistic inquiry. Still, many readers, writing readers perhaps, will find the most meaning in Rosen's carefully curbed but unmistakable personal passion for the bike. "Bike riding is the best way I know to reach an altered consciousness," he writes. "Better than yoga or wine or weed, it runs neck and neck with sex and coffee." All enthusiasms are slightly daffy, and at moments Rosen reaches a kind of embarrassed nirvana as he contemplates his subject, lovingly describing a trick rider's stunts, traversing Dhaka by rickshaw, or his own encounters with snow, car doors, and, of course, drivers, too many obnoxious, unfeeling drivers to number. Four Wheels Bad, that is the logical second half of the quote the book's title invites us to finish. After all, should we as a species be riding bicycles instead of driving cars? Probably. The automotive age is an age of carnage, Rosen writes. Some 1.2 million people die in car crashes each year. Not just that either. Motor vehicles are the largest net contributor to climate change. The ineluctable trouble is that cars have their own romance. Two Wheels Good does admirable battle with a fact without ever quite subduing it. For all the charm, usefulness, and elegance of the bike, we as a species seem to be drawn to its calamitously problematic successor. Unfortunately, we live in a different world than the one we want. Ice is melting at the top and bottom of the planet, the author writes. Forests are aflame. Political systems are fracturing. A pandemic has shaken daily life at its foundations. And amid the tumult, a new global bicycle culture is emerging. The question is whether it's in time. Would it be surprising if, however it comes, we all meet up after the apocalypse on bikes, humble, easy, indestructible? After reading Rosen's impassioned history, I was convinced of it. And there's a bike store nearby, too. I keep meaning to drive over there. This review was written by Charles Finch, who is the author of What Just Happened, A Chronicle of 2020. The Revolutionary Samuel Adams by Stacy Schiff. Schiff, the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer, draws on the writings of Samuel Adams' rivals and peers in this engrossing biography. Adams, one of America's most private and overlooked revolutionaries, is presented as an idealistic and incorruptible propagandist who wired a continent for rebellion. This Other Eden by Paul Harding. Harding has written a novel out of poetry and sunlight, violent history and tender remembering, inspired by an eviction that uprooted an entire mixed-race fishing community in 1912 Maine. It is one of the Book Review's 100 notable books of 2023. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review. My name is Nora Ami.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aincolorado.org. or by calling 303-786-7777.